Jerry, let me start with you. You say Lou Anne Henderson is a key figure in the formation of the Beats, and yet hardly anyone's heard of her. How does she figure into the story?
Well, Neil Cassady married her when she was 15 years old in Denver. He was this wild man who stole cars, had tons of women, wanted to be a writer, very energetic, didn't have much education, was actually in and out of reform schools. And he, at one point, you know, he wanted to go to Columbia because he knew a guy in Denver, an older man who was a counselor there. And so but he had no means of going there to Columbia. So at one point he steals... he married Lou Anne Henderson. He steals her uncle's car, drags her along. They run out of money. Then they ride he stole some money, Neil, along the way, and they end up in New York. And they've got some names and phone numbers. And of course, one of the people they meet is Allen Ginsberg. And then very shortly after that, they meet Jack Kerouac. These are all young men. They're not known. They're not famous. They're either at Columbia or just out of Columbia, like Kerouac. But so he's in New York, but he has no real way to get into Columbia, and he starts having adventures with these, you know, they're all kind of wild. They're looking for fun. Jack Kerouac wants to be a writer. They're looking for adventures. And so Lou Anne is tagging along, and she's witnessing all of this stuff. And she was actually a very bright woman. You don't know that by the book because, as I have told people, Jack Kerouac's female characters are very thin, unfortunately. Everybody knows his great male characters, Dean Moriarty in On the Road or Jaffe Ryder, which is based on Gary Snyder and the Dharma Bums. But the women that he drew in the books are very thin. And the way he draws Lou Anne, he calls her Mary Lou in On the Road, is this kind of blonde sex bomb, a ditz, nothing in her head, but she's just so extremely sexy. And actually, she was a very deep woman. She, you know, grown up during the Depression. She had had to go between Los Angeles and Denver when she was just a kid, 7, 8, 9 years old, because her parents had split up. She witnessed a lot of tragedy young. And of course, just being married to Neil Cassady, this wild man, was an education. But she was a very thinking person. And so she was aware enough of Neil and Jack to tell them about each other.
And you say that Jack and Neil were kind of wary of each other, and it was partly through Lou Anne's her warmth, her personality, she helped bring these two men together.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that Jack and Neil were very, very different at the beginning. You know, we're so used to seeing the pictures of them now with their arms around each other, and everywhere there's the icon of Jack and Neil, Jack and Neil. But when Jack Kerouac was, a good French-Canadian Catholic mama's boy from Lowell, Massachusetts, he was totally bought into the system. His parents had given him this drive to go to Columbia. They had no money, but he got to Columbia on a football scholarship. Get ahead in the world, Jackie. You know, make something of yourself. And, of course, he had the whole morality from the Catholic upbringing. He was bought into the system. Neil Cassady was not bought into the system at all. Neil grew up on a skid row in Denver. His mother was not even around. His father was a wino, a derelict. He had to fend for himself from 5 years old, stealing the change off of newsboxes. By the time Neil was 12, he was stealing cars and taking women up to the mountains for sex, or 13 years old. And he was in and out of reformatories. And at one point, he was in a reformatory that was almost like a penitentiary. So Neil had no investment in the system. They knew that they were very different. They were physically alike. I mean, they were strong, athletic, handsome. As Jack said it on the road, we tiptoed around each other warily because they didn't know if they could trust each other. But Lou Anne saw into the heart of both of them. She would tell Neil, you know, Jack is more than a Catholic mama's boy. He has great thoughts and profound thoughts about life. He wants to experience life. And she'd tell Jack, well, Neil is not just a jail kid from Denver. He read Nietzsche and Proust when he was in the reformatory. He also wants to make something of himself. So she was able to interest them in each other and begin to understand the depth in each other to the point where they could get close enough to become friends. And without that friendship, we wouldn't have had the Beat Generation.
You know, I sure agree with that.
Yeah. Well, Al, you knew these people very well. And you, in fact, you were part of some of the road trips that Jack Kerouac later wrote about and On the Road. And the impression...
Right.
I
feel like I was on part of the... Of Neil and Lou Anne on their first trip to New York, because they left for my apartment.
Well, you were on their second trip to New York. But you mean the first trip?
Yeah,
that's right. I'm sorry.
At 16 years of age, I was quite well acquainted with Lou Anne, and in fact, on their the decision to go to New York was made in my apartment.
Oh. And when you say 16, she was 16 or you were 16?
She was 16. Now, okay. I was just turned 20.
Uh-huh. You were Neil's age, exactly, right?
Yeah, Neil and I are the same age. And Neil was having an affair with another girl. And Luann came to my apartment when Neil and this other girl were in my apartment, and was quite upset about it because Neil had promised that he would have no more Jeannie was her name, no more Jeannie. And Luann said, "If we don't leave this day for New York, I'm leaving you." Mm. And I think that's the thing that pushed Neil into going, because the weather wasn't good. In fact, it really kind of sleeted when I drove him out to the edge of town where they could start hitchhiking.
Wow.
And they went up to Henderson, Nebraska, and then from there they had some adventures and finally end up in New York. I know that the first night they slept in a parked car that Neil found that was unlocked. And the second night they snuck into the dorms at Columbia. There was this kid from Denver that Neil was acquainted with. Hal Chase snuck into his dormitory the second night there. And then Neil was always able to get a job as parking cars.
He basically didn't have any money, right? So he had to pick up jobs
traveling. No money. By the time they got to New York, they were broke.
They used up the $300 they had stolen from her uncle or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, the impression I have of Neil Cassady is that he was a force of nature. Basically, he just overwhelmed everyone around him. Is that true?
That's pretty accurate. That's pretty accurate. He had this drive. Jerry just mentioned about the fact that Neil was reading all the philosophers. And I remember sitting in a car with him one time, and he's explained to me, a dummy at that time, I dropped out of school in the 10th grade, and there's another couple of kids in the car, and he's talking about the story of philosophy. And he's going through all these philosophers, from Spinoza on down. This goes on, you know, and you're talking about kids that are like 20 years old or younger for about 3 hours. and he was holding our interest. I mean, it's something that just blows your mind when you look back on it, that with all our testosterone and so forth, that we got to sit there like for 3 hours and listen to this discourse on philosophy.
Hmm. Well, that's one side of him. This young guy who loved books, who loved philosophy.
One little side of him, you know.
But there was another side of him too. Just by from all that I've read, just by sheer force of personality, he seemed to sweep along everyone else who was with him. Right?
Oh yes. He took center stage. There's no doubt about that. And but that was really fine for me because. He was quite a bit more red than I was. When I dropped out of school at 16, I eventually went into the Merchant Marine, and I did a lot of reading. I didn't drop out of school because I didn't like school. I really liked school. I dropped out of school because the war was on, and I was having trouble at home with my father and stepmother. And 16 years old, you could, during the Second World War, you could get jobs. And then, of course, I was about 6'2" and weighed 175 pounds. I could do a man's job, and quite often did. but when I got acquainted with Ginsberg and Jack and through Neil. It sparked a desire into me for learning. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I was able to graduate from college, got a scholarship down to Stanford, and was able to do a year of graduate work down there. And in fact, I'm the only one of the bunch that did graduate from college. It was all because of Neil and Jack and Alan and Al Chase and other influences at that time. Mm-hmm. So I got to give them the credit.
Yeah.
And Luann gets a lot of the credit.
Well, Jerry, how would you describe the personal dynamics between these early seminal beat figures, especially Kerouac and Cassidy and Allen Ginsberg?
Well, it's an interesting three-way in a way. I mean, Ginsberg was gay, somewhat in the closet, although by the time Neil came to New York in 1946, Allen was starting to emerge from the closet, starting to admit at least to close friends that he was gay. He was looking for a male lover. We need to say that both men and women fell in love with Neil instantly. I mean, you know, if you had any bisexual gay tendencies, you would fall in love with Neil, and likewise, women fell in love. He was handsome. He was full of energy. He was dynamic, as Al was saying. He could talk beautifully about anything. I think Al's point was that, you know, he could even take a philosophy book and make it sound interesting because he just had this. He was Irish. He had that gift of gab, and so he was an absolute charmer. So Neil, when he met Alan, Alan fell in love with him, and this was a problem in a way because Jack, who we later found was bisexual, but was not involved with Neil. Jack was looking for material. Jack was, again, the good Catholic mama's boy. He wants to be a writer, but you got to have something to write about. You don't get it living at home with mom. Here's this guy that's been in and out of penitentiaries, prisons, stolen cars, tons of women, been all over the country. Jack immediately saw, wow, this is somebody I could write about. This guy's got the adventures. Neil wanted to be a writer. So there was an interesting dynamic there where they kind of envied each other. Because Neil saw that Jack had the patience, and Jack was bright and had been gone to Columbia University. He had the patience, the training to sit down and be a writer. Neil wished he could do that. He was never able to do that. He was always moving so fast he couldn't sit down at a typewriter. So Neil envied Jack. Jack envied Neil in that, hey, because Jack had no way with women at all. Al can probably confirm that, but Jack did not. You know, he had a lot of trouble picking up women. He was very shy, awkward with women.
Even though Kerouac was a very good-looking guy.
Well, Luann talks about that in the book. She says, I couldn't believe a guy that handsome as Jack Kerouac was so unsure of himself with women. I mean, it astounded Luann. But no, he was. For some strange reason, he maybe the Catholic upbringing, the problems, you know, that he had because he was dominated by his mother all his life. But so Jack envied Neil with that, you know, Neil's courage, his confidence in the world, his ability to pick up women. They envied each other for the things that they wished, each one wished they had that the other one had. So there was an interesting, a liking, after Luann connected them, you know, a liking of each other, but also an envy, a little bit of a resentment, a little bit of wishing they were the other person. It troubled their relationship, and yet it made an interesting relationship because Neil became that subject for Jack. But again, it was a double-edged sword for Neil because, and Luann talks about this in my book, One and Only, that, Neil was honored that Jack wrote about him. It was a great honor to have someone like Jack write about him. But it sort of froze Neil in time because Neil wanted to go on beyond that. Neil had dreams of going to college, becoming a writer, doing other things with his life. But suddenly he was, you know, set like in a photograph. He was held in that moment, the young car thief, wild man, womanizer. And people expected Neil to live up to that role of Dean, called Dean Moriarty in On the Road. And so while it honored Neil, it also forced him to become a performer, to play that role, and kept him from moving forward with his life. So there was a lot of difficulty. Meanwhile, you had Ginsberg, who was jealous that Jack was getting so much of Neil's time. And then Ginsberg and Neil formed a close bond, and Jack became somewhat jealous of that bond. So and of course, Luann is in the midst of it all, and she becomes both Jack's lover as well as Neil's lover.
Well, and you also tell some stories about how there were times when Neil Cassady and Allen Ginsberg and Luann would sometimes just all sleep in the same bed together and, I guess, have sex all together.
Well, and Luann, as I in the introduction in my book, I talk about how I met Luann when she was in the hospital in San Francisco. And, you know, she was very upset by the way she had been portrayed in Carolyn Cassady's movie Heartbeat in 1979 as this kind of teenage slut. And one of the things that she told me, as I recount in the book, is that she said it wasn't dirty, it wasn't sleazy. You know, when we were in bed together, it was kind of nice. You know, it was like there was no big deal about it for her. And of course, she was very open for the time. And I do try to make a case for her in this book as kind of a pioneer of women's liberation. This is back in the 1940s, and she's saying, hey, it was okay for three of us to be in bed together.
Well, also, we were in Allen Ginsberg's apartment, and there was only one bed. Now, I was 6'6" at the time, but I took the cushions off the couch and slept in the living room, went for the living room. And if the others were going to sleep, they were going to have to sleep in that bed. There was only one bed. it was kind of crazy. Luann got a job to help out financially. It only lasted a week, but that's the kind of gal she was. She was always willing to help. In fact, she even hawked some rings she had at the pawnbrokers to give us spending money in New York, pulled her own weight. And my job in the morning, after we kind of party most of the night, was to wake Luann up, get her in the automobile and drive over to Cullen Holmes' apartment, where he let us use the shower, so Luann could go in and take a quick shower and get to her. Then I'd drive her to her job, and it was kind of strange because when I would go in to wake him up, sometimes Luann would be in the middle. Sometimes she'd be on the left side. Sometimes she'd be on the right side. But this was like friends. Mm. You know, it wasn't sex. It wasn't shocking. It was like what you do when you have to do it. There's only one bed. You're going to sleep in it, and if sex occurs, well, it occurs.
Well, one thing I'd like you to talk about, Al, because I interviewed Al. Well, I met Al years ago when I was writing my biography of Jack Kerouac, Memory Babe. That was 35 years ago, I think. But I also interviewed Al again for this book, One and Only. And he has a chapter in my book, One and Only, called Al Hinkle's Story. But I want Al to talk about this. One of the things we talked about, Al, when I was interviewing you like a year or two ago, was the fact that, as you were very close to Luann, also when you were both young. And
oh,
yes. You said Luann met with you, and she at one point she was saying, like, I know this guy is going to keep having other women, and I'm not sure. What do I do about it? Do I accept it? I mean, she was troubled by the fact that he had so many women, but she also loved him, right?
Right, yeah. And it got to the point where she just kind of accepted her place in the storyline, you might say.
Hmm. Well, and in fact, in some of the famous road trips that then later became part of On the Road, they had actually divorced by this point, right? But then Neil would swing by and pick her up. And, I mean, they were still sexually involved as they were taking these road trips, even though Neil had gone off and married another woman, in fact, had children with the other woman.
Had three children with Carolyn.
And they were sexually involved to the very end of Neil's life. And you can relate that because you helped bring them together in those days, a secret rendezvous, right, in the 60s?
Oh, yes, and like 57 when Jack's book was published. I picked up, I drove out and with a little car I had and picked Luann up, picked Neil up from the depot because he'd just come in from a passenger run down at San Luis Obispo. And the three of us went over to Berkeley and busted in on Jack just as he was opening the package of the of his publishers, the writers.
His author's copies of On the Road.
Yeah, his first sight of his book in print. Hmm. It was eight books the publisher had sent him. And the funny thing about it, he tried to hide them from us. And, of course, and then Neil spotted them and grabbed one. And then Neil really started off reading from chapter to chapter and jumping up and down and really getting all high. And
why did Jack try to hide the books that were telling the story of all of you?
He said, "You're going to hate me." He says, "You're going to hate me. You're not going to like what I had to write, you know." And then we had to spend 5 minutes telling Jack how much we loved him, regardless of what he might have said or didn't say, you know. And in some of it, I don't come off as a 100% character, you know, but I just loved Jack and I loved the way he writes. I love, you know, and there's no way we were going to be disappointed or something. We were just so happy for Jack. Mm-hmm. It'd been years since Town and the Country had been published, which was his first book.
And he had actually finished On the Road years earlier, right? He just couldn't get it published.
Oh yes, oh yeah. It was finished in probably by 52, I guess. Biographers know what this, you know, when he had finished it. But I was just so happy that he was, you know, getting back into having something published. And I loved Town in the Country. In fact,
Town in the City.
So thank you. Town in the City. Yeah, I really, really, I love that book, too. And it's a completely different type of writing. Mm-hmm.
Let me say something.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Can I say something here?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
What I want to say is about why he was so afraid of letting them see the book. Al does not come off too badly, but, you know, in On the Road, he basically says that when he and Luann were left alone together, they were abandoned by Neil in San Francisco, and they were staying together briefly in a hotel. And then he says, in the book, Jack says, you know, I chose to leave her because she was a whore. She went off running off with other men for money. I saw her in a car with a sailor. And this, you know, of course, really angered Luann. But the interesting thing she told me in this long interview that I print in the book that I had done with her in 1978, she said the real thing was that, we stayed in a hotel together after Neil abandoned us. We had no money. But I wanted Jack to, like, go out and get a job. Get us an apartment, Jack. She was a teenage girl, and he was already, like, 26, 27 years old. She expected him to take charge. And she said every night he lay in bed in my arm and he cried. He was like a baby. He couldn't, and again, he would have been cared for by his mother all his life. He really was incapable of going out and getting a job and getting an apartment, setting up a place for himself and Luann to live. But he couldn't tell that. He couldn't tell that in the book. He never tells in the book that he lay in her arms and he cried like a baby. He changed it to, oh, she ran off with this guy she was whoring. There's some interesting things like that in her interview where you find out that what he wrote in the book was really not what happened.
And the guy that she ran off with was a guy that she knew before. He was a merchant marine, or he wasn't a sailor. He was a merchant marine.
Yeah.
And in fact, he thought they were engaged, and the rings that she hawked in New York was actually the rings that this Cole in the book Jack says the sailor, but she knew this fellow from before the trip to New York.
But Jack had to explain why he couldn't, you know, set up housekeeping, live with Luann, and he couldn't say that he was, you know, too weak to do it. So he had to put the blame on her.
Right. Hmm. He put the blame on her. And she knew this. You know, Len knew it and accepted it, and loved Jack all the more. You know.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think brought all of you together during this? I mean, we're talking late 40s here. You know, there were 3 years where there were a bunch of road trips, which formed the basis of Kerouac's On the Road. What were all of you looking for?
I think we were looking for the meaning of life. You know, and so in that sense, the war was over, which affected each of us differently. There was a lot of freedom in the United States, so much more than you have today. That you know, you could actually go hitchhiking and expect to get a ride,
not get murdered.
Yeah,
and in fact, wasn't that how you often paid for the gas? I mean, you didn't have money yourselves, so you would hope that the people you'd pick up could contribute to the gas money.
Right. Yeah, and just ask them. Oh, can you come up with a dollar or two? If not, we're going to take you to, you know, anyway. And in fact, this one, I got to say, I got to mention the ethnic here because it's part of the story. It's a Jewish kid that we picked up, and he was headed down towards Florida, and we were headed to New Orleans, and he didn't have any money. But he did say that you stop in the next town down here, which was a fairly good-sized city. I don't know, 40 or 50,000 people, I saw like that. He says, go down Main Street and stop at a jewelry store, and I'll go in and get some money. Oh, boy, I said, oh, no, we can't do anything like that. He says, no, I won't rob the place. He says, I'll just ask for it, and he'll give it to me. And with this confidence, and we stopped, and I still wouldn't let him go in the store by himself, though I went with him, because I didn't understand this at all. But he walks up to the man and explains who he is, and he mentioned congregation, but that's not the word I'm looking for.
The synagogue
that he belonged to up in New York, and he was headed to Florida, and he wanted $5 from him, and he says, I will if you give me your card, it'll be mailed back to you, and because we want to get something to eat, and get out of town. And the guy said, if you promise you're going to leave town right away, I'll gladly give you the $5. And he did. Hmm. And I was amazed.
Hmm. So you said that you were all, well, to put it grandly, you were looking for the meaning of life. But you said that this was a time of great freedom. And it sounds like there was, I mean, you were also rebelling against something else. You were rebelling against the old way of life. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And, rebelling against any restrictions we come up against, you know, but we had to be in a society. But I don't think we were consciously rebelling against society per se, or the anarchist thoughts or anything like this. Mainly, we're just looking for fun and freedom, and really a good time and a learning experience, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say something about that too, because you know, I was an advisor to the movie of On the Road, which is going to premiere at Cannes on May 23rd, and Walter Salles was a wonderful director, and I really love him, and he's a very brilliant man, but he. He kept trying to get. I was coaching the actors, and he kept saying, "Well, tell the actors how these people, meaning Jack and Al Hinkle here, and Luann, and how they wanted to create a revolution." And I said, no, I don't think that they set out to create a revolution. Because Salas, as you probably know, did the film Motorcycle Diaries about Che Guevara, which is a very political film, and it's about a revolutionary. And I think he wanted to sort of see Jack Kerouac as this same sort of political revolutionary. And I said, no, it wasn't, because... And also when I talked to Luann, and Luann shed some very interesting light on this, she said, we were trying to make something of ourselves. Neil wanted to become a writer. We wanted to be better than we were. We wanted to do something good with our lives. Sometimes we didn't have any money, so we had to steal some gasoline. Sometimes Neil didn't have a car, so he had to steal a car. She said, but we didn't do it like, you know, we're setting out to be, blatant criminals, or we're setting out to create a revolution. She said we were trying to do something and make our lives better. Would you agree with that, Al?
Oh, yes, absolutely. After I met these people, and they blew my mind with their knowledge, the books that they had read, and the other people we met, of course, in New York, like Cullen Holmes and friends of his. I just wanted to get into books. I just wanted to read and read. I wanted to study. And when we got back to California, and then I got back on the railroad, which was very seasonal, and it allowed me to pick up some college units. Mm. And I chose the University of Denver because when I had taken my high school equivalency test in Colorado, they told me I passed in the upper tenth of my graduating class, and I could get into any Colorado college without bothering with the entrance exam, which I was afraid I would fail. I was very insecure. So when I did get into college, I took what I thought would be easy courses for me, like history and algebra. And then, of course, you have to take an English course and beginning psychology course. And I got good grades there. And then later I could transfer those grades and was accepted in San Francisco and University of San Francisco. And was able to, because the railroad was so seasonal, I was able to continue my education. I tried to get Neil to do this, but he just had too much energy, too much go, that when he got laid off, which he'd get laid off about the same time I did, because our seniorities weren't that much different, he would take off for New York.
Hmm. Well,
be with his friends again.
Let me ask you about some of the road trips that Kerouac, of course, immortalized in On the Road. Did you all take these trips basically just to get to your final destination, or was it partly to see America as well?
For me, it was to see more of America. And to fulfill a promise. I promised Neil, this was long before I met the lady that became my wife, that I promised Neil when we got laid off, we were going to go to New York. I was going to help him with the expenses, and we were going to have fun when we got to New York. And he was telling me about all these people that he had met and wanted to introduce me to. Kerouac and Ginsberg and other people.
Was this the trip in December of 1949 you're talking about?
Yeah, the one we left from San Francisco.
December
right?
of 48 and 48, January 49.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this January was, you had gotten a new car, but there was no heater?
Well, yes, that was a kind of an amazing thing. Everything was on automobiles was extra, and we actually picked this car up not at a dealership but a kind of a warehouse, because they were adding like the radio and the heater and so forth would be done workshop at a garage, not the dealership. And I put up a couple hundred dollars on the down payment. I can't remember how much. And then Neil put up the other part of the down payment. But we elected not to get the heater because that was going to be another $90, and that was right up front money. We had to, you know.
Didn't you tell me you wanted to get the radio instead of the heater? Wasn't that the deal?
Oh, we had to have the radio, regardless of what that cost.
But, so you were blaring music as you were going, but freezing in the process.
That's about it. And but tell you about what a trooper Luann is. You know, when I was driving, and she's actually scraping ice off the inside of the windshield, and they're there in Nebraska one time, so we can look out. And I didn't have any gloves, and my hands are freezing. And she takes one hand and puts it down her pants between her legs to warm my hand up. Absolutely non-sexual friend move. She warmed my hand up, and then I warmed up the other hand. And I just, I'd just go through hell for that woman if it was necessary, you know, because she, you know, would do this for me, you know. And
what was on the radio?
Oh, well, gee, we kept the radio going 24 hours a day. It was any reception we could get, you know.
Music mainly that you were playing?
Oh, yeah, it's all music. Yeah, it was just music, really. Some of the big bands, I remember some of the big bands. Neil liked anything with a good saxophone going. And or a good drummer, like Koopa, saxophone player or drummer. And there was one weird thing on that trip. I don't know if you've ever heard the story that the three of us are driving through the country, and late at night, and I'm in the back seat of this Hudson, and I'm laying down, and it's so wide, it's not really comfortable. And of course Luann and Neil are up in the front seat, and they think I'm asleep back there, and they get talking about New York and so forth. And Luann says that I'm not going as your mistress. You know, she says, I'm going for myself. I'm going to have fun, and I'm not going to be concerned 100% with you. And Neil says, oh, that's fine. I don't care if you want to bet anybody, that's your business, you know. And he said, except. I said, I don't want you fooling around with Hinkle. That was the one exception he put on it.
Why? Why did he say that?
Well, you know, for years and years and years, I give that a lot of thought, you know. A lot of thought. And I think he was afraid it would change our relationship somehow. And he didn't want to do that. Luann thought it might be just a little bit that he was a little bit jealous of me.
Hmm. Well, and wasn't Neil a kind of a jealous type when it came to his women? He really didn't want them to go off with other guys.
Well, so sometimes he forced them on other guys, though. He certainly forced Luann on Jack. I think that, you know, Al has a point because, you know, again, sometimes we think of Neil, well, he had everything. He was so charming and athletic. But, you know, he was very insecure. He had grown up on Skid Row in Denver. He did envy Al. I think the fact that Al had more stability as a worker. Al, you know, had a family, married, had a home. Neil, I think admired Al and wished in a way he could be a more stable human being, you know, more connected to the world with family and so on, as Al was, because Neil didn't have any of that. So I think in some respects, yeah, Neil would have liked to be more like Al, but he couldn't be. I mean, Neil could never be connected anywhere. He was always shooting off like a pinball.
Yep, Jerry sure's got that right. He sure does have that right down, right down pat. Yeah.
So getting back to On the Road, because that's really what we're talking about to some degree, was the story behind On the Road. What do you think Jack Kerouac was looking for in these road trips? What did he try to do in that book?
Oh, I think he was trying to find out who in the hell are these guys from the West, and what makes us tick. I think he was he wanted to figure it out. He wanted to write it down and figure it out. And his friend Cullen Holmes was, in a sense, the same way. Now, Cullen Holmes parted with us and was with us many, many, many of those days and evenings. And unbeknown to us or unbeknown to Jack or anybody, Cullen Holmes would go home, and then he would write 2 or 3 hours. And by the time we left, New York for New Orleans, he just about had a book ready to go.
But you see, John Cullen Holmes was a much more traditional writer in the fact that, you know, he would write the certain number of hours every day, smoke the pipe, you know, have the typewriter in his home. Jack, interestingly, was trying to develop a new model for the writer as somebody who actually goes out and lives the life that he's writing about. I mean, actually, it had been done with Jack London, and later on it would be done with people like, they call them the new journalists, like Hunter S. Thompson. You know, you live the life that you're writing about. What interested Jack, because Jack did come out of this intellectual milieu. He'd been at Columbia, you know, and Ginsberg in those days was quite an intellectual too, and John Cullen Holmes. They'd sit around these apartments in New York, and they'd be pondering the meaning of life, you know, Nietzsche and discussing the philosophers. But Jack realized they weren't getting anywhere with all these discussions about philosophers. Neil came in and he introduced a new mode, you know, and rather than just sit around and let's see, what is the meaning of life? Just go out and live it. Just live it. Just keep living it. Don't stop. And that, I think, really attracted Jack. Get away from this brooding, pondering, sit in the apartment with your pipe and type 3 hours a day. Follow Neil. Go out and live it, and the answers will still come to you. In fact, one of the most famous lines in On the Road, he says, Jack says, I knew that somewhere along the line the pearl would be handed to me. Hmm. If I keep going far enough and fast enough, somewhere the pearl will be handed to me. That's the pearl of wisdom, will finally come to me.
Yep, that's true. You know, when Jack was on the railroad and he worked those two seasons, 52 and 53, this is before On the Road was published. It was completed. When Jack would get down, like, to Watsonville, we had a dormitory that all the brakemen stayed at, but not Jack. Where Jack went was down under the Bajaro River Bridge, where the transients, someplace would call them hobos or bums, and he would bring a little something down there with him to cook and share, and he would sit and talk to the and take a nap and so forth, sleep with the hobos and spend a few hours down there. Then he'd wander back to the railroad because he didn't want to, you know, miss the train or something, and then he would tell him the crew dispatcher, "I'll be over in such and such a caboose," but. That was that's what Jack did in when he was down in Watsonville. Hmm.
So partly what he wanted to do is he had a hunger to learn about other people unlike himself.
Oh yeah, down there talking to the bums.
Was this partly to gather material for his writing? I mean, was this all kind of fodder for On the Road?
Yeah, I would
know, because On the Road had been finished, you know.
No, but he was always writing, Al.
He's on another book.
No, but he was. I would say that a lot of his life was to gather material for writing.
He had this little
breast pocket notebooks, yeah,
in his shirt pocket, and he would write in that little sentences or paragraph and pick up a little something, and.
Did you ever see him, Al, taking notes?
I saw him lots of times taking notes, you know. And Jack kind of liked the railroad. He wasn't really a good brakeman, but he liked the railroad, and he liked the money. Because if you really put your nose to the grindstone, you can work like 7 days a week during the harvest seasons. At that time, it was so seasonal. he could pick up a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this one, I guess it was the second year that Jack was here. He only cashed the first check. All the rest of them he just held on to until he got laid off. Then he turned them all into traveler's checks because he wanted to go to Mexico and maybe get a house down there and send for Carolyn and the kids and write. Hmm. And he thought he would have enough money to do that, write a book.
Hmm.
Well, by the time he got to Mexico, I think Carolyn had changed her mind and wasn't going to go off to Mexico with Jack.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, speaking of Mexico, Al, I want to ask about another trip you took to Mexico with William Burroughs. What was that like, and what was Burroughs like?
Oh, well, I went down to Mexico with a friend, Bill Thompson, from Denver, and his wife was named Helen. And we drove down to Mexico City, and we enrolled in Mexico City College, which was a school that was set up by seven or eight American universities for their students to go to Mexico and live and study for 1 year or one semester or whatever they wanted to. And they would study architecture, Spanish, history of Mexico, anthropology, and these type of courses. And all the lectures were given in English. And they were open to Mexican citizens, of course. And about half the students were natives, I could say, Mexican natives, citizens of Mexico. And about three-fourths of those were girls. Mm. The families wanted them to learn some English. And
so where does Burroughs fit into the story?
Well, we looked him up when we got there. We looked him up, him and Joan, and spent, I guess, maybe two afternoons and one evening with him. But he was curing himself of a heroin addiction. And he was doing this by keeping drunk with tequila. he was, at least that's what Joan was telling us. So most of the times that we saw him, he was drunk. So,
so not very good company.
He wasn't very good company, you know. But I always admired him, you know, because he could just talk on any subject. And I remember him talking one time on prefabricated housing.
That was one of his things he liked.
Yeah, he gets all hung up on things like that, and or horse racing, and so forth. And fortunately, I wasn't there when he shot his wife.
How soon were you there before the shooting? Do you know or not?
I can't remember. Mm. You know, old age, I guess. Mm. But I got called back from the railroad, and I had to be back within 30 days. So I kind of wound up my quarter, and took a couple examinations, and I was very lucky in that the Southern Pacific got me transportation right out of Mexico City all the way to Nogales on a Pullman.
Mm, wow.
With meals included. And then from Nogales to San Francisco, I was on my own railroad, so to speak, and I could just use my employee pass and got back to San Francisco back to work on the railroad.
Let me ask you a question. Now, did you think that these guys were going to become famous writers when you knew them, like Burroughs and Kerouac?
I was absolutely convinced that by the time I was well acquainted with Alan, I couldn't give you an exact year, But I was convinced he was going to win the Nobel Prize for poetry.
Ginsberg.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. What about Kerouac? Did you think he would become a famous writer?
Yes. I just couldn't believe that because of Town in the City was such a great book that the publishers had waited all that length of time, all those years, to bring out another book. And this book is 100 degrees opposite as far as the writing style,
Right. Mm-hmm.
This was like instantaneous creation. And I argued with Jack about it, I'm afraid I was the conservative. I said, you got to rewrite a little bit, you're writing along and you meant to say hat and you write down and you're hitting the keys and it says cat. Are you just going to go on and change it, And he said, well, maybe cat was what your subconscious mind is telling you to, So, we discussed, he discussed literature with me, of all people, but over a chess set, so I guess it was all right,
Well, Jerry, how do you look back on the road? And what do you see as the legacy of that book?
Well, it's an amazing book in that it keeps speaking to generation after generation of young people. I was recently on a book tour for One and Only, and I was at some colleges back in Chicago where I grew up. And again, 18- and 19-year-old college students are coming up to me and saying, this book has changed my life. And I think that, it's a perennial inspiration for young people, because what this book tells you, it's a fundamental human lesson. It tells you that you cannot find yourself by listening to government, church, family, parents. The only way to find yourself is to experience life, to listen to what's inside yourself, your own heart, your own conscience, your own intuition. And don't be afraid of anything. Go out and experience life firsthand. And young people need to hear that, because in any period, especially, of course, in the 50s, but there was a heavy parental hand of you have to do this. But kids always get this. You have to do this. You have to do that. They're being told how to live life. And at some point, they have to break through that and say, no, I'm going to find my own way. And this book kind of gives young people the permission to do that, I think.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
That is so right. It kind of reminds me, if we get into politics, of Ron Paul, it's like 78 years old. When he goes on to campuses and so forth, he's really turning young people on to this idea of less government, mm-hmm. more freedom, get out of these wars, don't try to be the policeman to the world, and that they can make this generation gap, this guy, this old, mm-hmm. Where his main supporters seem to be people 18 to 25.
Let me come back to Kerouac for a moment. Do you think Kerouac was happy with On the Road? I mean, after it came out, after he got acclaim, he also got criticism. Was this the book that he had always wanted to do?
No, I think he was looking to go on and explore. It wasn't the end for him. It was like a step forward, maybe three steps forward and a half a step back.
Well, no, he knew it was, and you're right, Al. Al's absolutely right. But what I was going to say is that he knew it was a major work. He knew that he had made a breakthrough, a new style, what he called spontaneous prose, that he was writing about new aspects of American life that other people hadn't written about, this generation that was dissatisfied after World War II, was, breaking the sexual mores, was trying out drugs, was trying to experience more freedom. He was the first person to really write about that after World War II, and he knew that he had done a significant book. Yes, he wanted to do more, but I think that one of the things, you know, you mentioned the attacks, and there were enormous attacks. The original review, which was done by a jazz critic, the first review in the New York Times was a mistake because the actual book reviewer was out of town, and they gave the book to the jazz reviewer, Gilbert Milstein, who loved it and wrote this rave review saying this is the testament of the new generation. It's like Hemingway and the Lost Generation. It put Kerouac on the map. But as soon as the regular reviewer came back, he trashed the book. And every review after that trashed the book. They said, this man is a black spot on America. That's a quote. He's a spokesman for thugs. That's a quote. They said he's promoting juvenile delinquency. Kerouac did not expect that at all. He didn't realize, I think, that he was venturing into such new territory that he was going to be vastly attacked for it. And I think it really damaged him a whole lot.
Yes.
Go ahead, Al.
I was just verbally agreeing with you. Yeah, that was it, Jack. And he really was hurt emotionally by all these attacks, you know. And I don't know that this maybe was one of the factors that they drank so much.
I think so. I mean, you know, a lot of these reviewers or critics didn't see the spiritual dimension of the book. You know, they saw and of course the publishers aided and abetted this because the publishers wanted to sell books, and what sells books is talking about sex and drugs and getting high, and they would, you know, put a cover on the book that showed, you know, a loosely clad young woman smoking pot or something. The publishers were promoting the book in that direction, but the book, it really has a great deal of spiritual depth. Kerouac sees God's fingers in the clouds pointing, saying, go thou and tell truly. There's a character, this old man in the book who's with the long beard walking down the road saying, go moan for man, go moan for man, the suffering of man. You know, there's this great spiritual depth, but so few people saw that in the book. They just picked up, and, you know, thanks to the publishers too, they just picked up on this superficial thing of the kicks, the sex. And I think that really bothered Jack too, that they didn't see that he was a very spiritual person.
Of course, here we are, you know, more than 50 years later. Kerouac, of course, has long since departed. But it's an institution in American letters. It's, as you were saying, Jerry, a book that continues to be read by new generations of people. And we now have a movie of the book. So it lived on very much so.
Well, I think the movie is going to have an enormous impact, too. I mean, I was part of the, advising it. I worked with the actors. The actors were all, they're young people, but they were Garrett Hedlund, Kristen Stewart, Sam Riley, but they're all deeply committed to portraying the real roles and the real thoughts that Kerouac wanted to. Walter Salles, a brilliant director. There's a great cast, supporting cast. You know, there's Kirsten Dunst, there's Steve Buscemi, Amy Adams. People don't, for some reason, it's been produced by a very small company in France, MK2. The rights were held by Francis Ford Coppola for years, since 1980, and he couldn't get anybody to write a usable script. So finally, in despair, Coppola gave the rights to Walter Salles, who had done Motorcycle Diaries. But so whatever, because of this small company, they've kept this thing under wraps. I haven't talked much about it. It's going to be released at Cannes on May 23rd, but I think when it's released, it's going to, you can quote me on this, it's going to be like a bombshell, and I think Jack Kerouac's going to have an even bigger resurrected life than he's already had.
I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah. We are out of time. Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, quite wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and for coming into the studio.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. And I just have to say I just loved Luann all my life, you know. I'm glad she has got this book that's telling somewhat of her story, you know.
And we should mention that Al Hinkel just wrote a small memoir of his own life, which he published. What's it called, Al? Tell us.
Oh, Last Man Standing.
Last Man Standing. Can they get it on the internet, or can they find
right.
it?
Al, www.alhinkel.com. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Good to know. Okay. We are out of time, so I need to let the studio go. So thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome
okay.
very much.
Okay. Yep. Bye-bye.